Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I am James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, March 27, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Vice President Kamala Harris continues her visit to Ghana today, Monday.
Ghana, I think, is a key political player in West Africa, and it's quite true that they are working hard to solve the Sahel problem. So I think Ghana can play an important role because of its strong political weight in West Africa.
We'll hear more about Vice President Harris's visit from Ken Mesa in Accra. Battle lines are drawn for Raila Odinga's call for more protests in Kenya today, Monday. A Rwandan government spokesperson gives details about the release of Paul Rusesabagina.
Paul Rusesabagina made a request for clemency, as provided for by our laws. He accepted more responsibility on the crimes he was convicted of, and he has also made important pledges for his future conduct, including his exit from politics.
And a female biochemist and activist wants to become Zimbabwe's next president. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Vice President Kamala Harris continues her trip to Ghana today, Monday, where she is expected to have a bilateral meeting with President Nana Akufo-Addo of Ghana. According to the White House, she will also visit a recording studio in Accra and meet with young people in the creative industry. The trip to Ghana is the first leg of Vice President Harris's three-nation Africa tour that will also take her to Tanzania and Zambia. Ambassador Herman J. Cohen is the former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs under former President George H.W. Bush. He tells me that the vice president's visit is a follow-up to last December's U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit hosted by the White House and also a recognition of the important role that Ghana plays in West Africa.
Well, the trip was part of President Biden's new approach to Africa. Remember, he had an Africa summit in Washington, and he said we want more partnerships. Up to now, it's been mainly U.S. charity to Africa. But now we want partnerships where the U.S. will provide assistance, but the Africans must show that they have good governance and the ability to attract private investors. So it's a continuation of new partnerships, and the vice president's trip is just a continuation of President Biden's new approach to Africa.
The vice president's trip is coming as many African countries are facing serious economic challenges, particularly debt and also new inroads by China and Russia. Could it be argued, Ambassador, that one purpose of the vice president's visit is for the U.S. to counter the influences of Russia and China?
Well, the U.S. government, the press spokesman hasn't said that, but I think underlying all this, that's part of it. What the Russians are doing are mainly bringing more hardship to Africa with their military, who are absorbing resources. For example, in Central African Republic, they control the diamonds, and that is not healthy. And the Chinese are doing a lot of infrastructure. But at the same time, they bring in a lot of their Chinese workers and who import cheap Chinese goods and undermine local industries. I think the best example of that is Kano, Nigeria. Kano, Nigeria used to be a thriving industrial city, but ever since the Chinese started importing cheap Chinese goods, Kano is totally in decline, you see. So I don't say that the U.S. is competing with Russia and China, but I think it's a way of demonstrating to the Africans that there's a more healthy way of having partnerships with the international community.
Vice President Harris is going to go to three African countries, starting with Ghana. Let's talk first about Ghana, which has been playing a major role in the efforts by the economic community of West African states to tame the worsening security situation in the Sahel region. What's the importance of Ghana?
Well, Ghana, I think, is a key political player in West Africa, and it's quite true that they are working hard to solve the Sahel problem. After all, the Sahel problem is gone on for over 10 years now, and it's Africans killing Africans. It's not healthy, and there is a solution to that, which would bring about greater efforts by the people who live in the southern part of the Sahel to share revenue with people living in the northern part of the Sahel. So I think Ghana can play an important role because of its strong political weight in West Africa.
You mentioned, Ambassador, the U.S.-Africa summit, and President Biden during that summit promised that he will visit Africa. Could this visit by Vice President Harris be, let's say, a prelude to the president going to Africa?
Absolutely, yes. The president has promised to go to Africa. I'm sure he will go. I don't know what date, but I would say it's before the end of 2023. I'm sure he will go.
Ambassador Herman J. Cohen is the former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs under President George H.W. Bush. He was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris arrived in Ghana on Sunday as part of a three-nation Africa tour aimed at strengthening U.S. relations on the continent. Although Ghana and the United States have a close friendship dating back to 1957, China is now a far larger trading partner with Ghana than the U.S. Kent Mensah reports from Accra on how Harris's trip could impact U.S. trade with Ghana.
In the last decade, Ghanaian trader Gifty Ama Owusu has been selling Chinese textiles, including satin fabric, in the busy central business district of Accra. She tells VOA, although Chinese products are of poor quality, they are affordable and sell more quickly than expensive ones imported from the U.S. and other Western countries.
Hey, cheap. Hey, affordable.
They're cheap. With as little as 100 Ghana cedis, you can buy something to wear. So why won't Ghanaians patronize Chinese goods rather than those coming from the U.S. and Europe? Textiles from the U.S., or even the locally made ones, are very expensive despite being of good quality.
Over the years, China has built up bilateral and trade relations with Ghana. On Tuesday, construction began on a $20 million Foreign Ministry Annex building in Ghana that will be entirely paid for by China. Accra, which faces its worst economic crisis in decades, is currently in talks with Beijing to restructure its $1.7 billion debt to China. But one expert says Ghana has not seen a key benefit expected from Chinese infrastructure projects.
China is bringing in all these manufacturing entities, but we are not seeing technology transfer. You know, a lot of it has been said in the forum on China-Africa cooperation that, you know, many of them, we've had about 11 or 8, 10 of such conferences where the issue of technology transfer has been said consistently as the Chinese come into Africa and engage us. But we are not seeing this, you know, so we are in a hard place.
Harris's visit to Ghana is meant to build on the recent U.S.-African Leaders Summit that President Biden hosted in Washington in December. The U.S. government has over the years supported Ghana in areas such as healthcare, agriculture, trade, and security. Amwa said the U.S. needs to re-strategize to keep its allies in Africa before losing them to China.
If they want to break into the African market again, or at least maybe reposition themselves. I think that should be the issue. Reposition themselves so that they engage us at the level of a win-win kind of engagement. These are some of the things they must begin to look at if they're really interested. Trade, yes. Aid, maybe. Investments, which kind of investments? These are big questions.
Asked about the vice president's visit, Ghana's deputy foreign affairs minister, Kweku Amprachum Sapon, told VOA via text message that Ghana-U.S. relations continue to grow and that Ghana is looking forward to leveraging the opportunities that come with Kamala Harris's visit. Kent Mensah for VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
A spokesperson for the government of Rwanda has been providing details about Friday's release of Paul Rusesabagina, the man portrayed in the film Hotel Rwanda. Rusesa Bagina, a Belgian citizen and U.S. legal resident, was found guilty in 2021 on terrorism charges and sentenced to 25 years. He denied the allegations. A Rusesa Bagina family member told VOA the family was not in the capacity to speak about his freedom. Rwandan government spokesperson Yolande Makolo says while there has been a lot of international attention to Rusesa Bagina's case, Rwanda has a history of forgiving even the unforgivable, including those found to have played a role in the country's 1994 genocide.
Paul Rusesa Bagina and Calixte Nsabimana, along with 18 members of the FLN militia that were convicted with them, had their prison sentences commuted by presidential order. First of all, if you know the recent history of Rwanda, and as President Kagame has said, Rwandans have forgiven the unforgivable. Even people who committed genocide here have found themselves freed and back in the community. So with this case, it's important to note that there is consensus that serious crimes were committed by Rusesa Bagina and his FLN militia, for which they were convicted. And under Rwandan law, commutation of sentence does not extinguish the underlying conviction or the obligation for compensation to the victims as decided by the court. Paul Rusesa Bagina made a request for clemency as provided for by our laws. He accepted more responsibility on the crimes he was convicted of, and he has also made important pledges for his future conduct, including his exit from politics.
Yolande, did your government release Mr. Rusesa Bagina just to avoid international isolation or pressure?
There has certainly been a lot of international interest in this case, mainly because of a successful Hollywood film from, 15 or more years ago. The U.S. was particularly interested, given that Rusesa Bagina is both a Rwandan citizen and an American resident. However, Rwanda has always maintained the serious concerns we have with this case, especially around political violence by armed groups, including those that are led by people operating from the safety of developed countries. This is something that the United States has agreed with us on, as laid out last night in last night's statement by the State Department, as well as the decision by the U.S. to retroactively rescind the wrongful detention assessment. So suddenly there were a few false starts, but Rwanda and the U.S. were able to have constructive discussions carried out on the basis of mutual respect and an understanding of the real issues, particularly Rwanda's concerns about the safety and security of our population.
What becomes of those who were convicted along with Mr. Rusesa Bagina? Are they also going to be released?
Those convicted alongside Paul Rusesa Bagina, including Calixte Nsabimana and 18 other members of the armed militia, FLN, have also had their sentences commuted. They are now free men, and we expect that as former combatants, they will go through the demobilization and rehabilitation program, and this will facilitate their integration back into Rwandan society.
Yolande Makolo is spokesperson for the government of Rwanda. She was speaking with us from the capital, Kigali. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, March 27. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley's Force. Tunisia's Coast Guard says that at least 29 migrants have died after two boats capsized off the southern coast of Tunisia. This follows the sinking in the past week of five other boats as part of an unprecedented surge of migration from Tunisia to Italy. From Tunis, Alicia Folkman has the story.
On Sunday, over 29 people died when two boats taking migrants to Italy sank off the coast of the southern city of Sfax, which is about 270 kilometres from the Tunisian capital. The Coast Guard says it has stopped around 80 vessels heading for Italy in the past 4 days and detained more than 3,000 migrants, mostly from sub-Saharan African countries. Ramdan Benamour of the Tunisian Forum for Economic and Social Rights explains what has triggered the surge in crossings. He says after President Kais Saied spoke against sub-Saharan foreign migrants on February 21st, there was a wave of violence against those from the region. The refugees and migrants can no longer work or rent a house. As a result, Tunisia has been transformed from a safe place to somewhere unlivable for black African migrants, so they prefer to risk the crossing to Italy. Benamor says this has caused a surge in migration out of Tunisia. He says, this weekend, both the Italian and Tunisian authorities said that there has been a sharp rise in crossings. The Tunisian Coast Guard recorded some 14,000 departures from the country, four times last year's figures. Migrants do not have any alternatives right now. Tunisian authorities must work to calm the situation and look after those most in need who are without papers. He says the European Union also needs to take responsibility for migrants and refugees and protect the most vulnerable here in Tunisia. Benamor says that Tunisia's police are failing to dismantle the trafficking networks running these dangerous boat voyages. Michael, a migrant from Sierra Leone, says he paid over $1,000 to cross the Mediterranean with such traffickers.
It was on Wednesday. I tried to cross the sea to go to Italy, but definitely the police would need to catch us to send us back to Tunisia. You know, the Tunisian people don't like us, they want to move out of their country. I don't really know what is the main problem, that they did not allow us to move. Things are very well challenging. I'm really stressed.
Europe sees Tunisia's economic fragility as a cause for increased migration. Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, who leads a far-right party in government, has called on the International Monetary Fund to offer financial support to help the country avoid economic collapse and prevent further surges in migration. But people like Michael do not understand why they are being sent back to Tunisia, where he says black people are not wanted and he has no chance of earning a living as a stonemason. Unable to return to Sierra Leone or go to Europe, he and his friends have risked all, lost everything, and are going nowhere. For Voice of America Africa, I'm Alicia Folkman in Tunis, Tunisia.
In Kenya, it appears the battle lines have been drawn for Monday's expected mass protest called by opposition leader Raila Odinga. He wants his supporters to show their displeasure with the high cost of living and to claim what he called victory. Odinga lost last August election to current President William Ruto, according to the Electoral Commission and the country's Supreme Court. Kenyan police have said the protest will be illegal. On the other hand, Odinga has called on his supporters to turn out every Monday and Thursday for what he calls peaceful demonstrations. The Kenyan Catholic Bishops' Conference last week called for a dialogue between Raila and Ruto. Joseph Kioko is the Kenyan political analyst. He tells me that Odinga should accept the will of the electorate because demonstrations serve no purpose other than to cause political mischief.
I think this is a political problem that is being handled in a bad manner. Honorable Raila is seeking to settle political scores through demonstrations on matters that had been adjudged by the Supreme Court of Kenya to have been resolved. When you listen to his demands, especially on the matter of opening up of the server, the Supreme Court gave a ruling and the country has moved on. The election period is over. So this demonstration serves no purpose at all, other than a political mischief.
You said this is a political problem that should be resolved through political means. How?
Yeah, this is a political problem which the Honorable Raila needs to accept the verdict of the people. The Honorable Raila demand for the server openings is a political problem. These are tactics that were used in 2017. These were tactics that were used in 2007. The net result is an artificial crisis being created that leads to a possible non-formal handshake or a cohabitation in government between the people in government and the people in the opposition. And those political machinations have never worked before. They've never helped anybody when you have a weakened opposition. When you have a government which is a mongrel, those in government are in opposition and those in opposition are in government. Nothing gets resolved in the country.
The Kenyan Catholic Bishops Conference is calling for some dialogue. What do you make of that?
It's a hard call. You know, you cannot have a compromise between food and poison. One will suffer. In this particular case, when the Catholic bishops are asking for dialogue, it's really dialogue based on what? Is it dialogue to bring in the Right Honorable Raila Odinga back into government? Is that the end result of the dialogue? Can the dialogue not be held by members of parliament who have just been given a mandate coming from the previous election? Are there no leaders in the country that can engage the national leadership into a constructive policy-oriented conversation, really, we must respect institutions of leadership to play their role. Asking for that dialogue negates the essence of general election in the country. Because every election, the losers will come out and cause mayhem, and then religious leaders will appear and ask for a dialogue. So where does it leave us as a country?
So what do you make of President Ruto calling on the international community to impose sanctions on Raila?
I think Ruto is duty-bound. If our country has to grow, we need to respect the will of the people. We need to understand that when we go into an electoral process, there'll always be winners and there'll be losers. And the losers need to accept the outcome of the election and allow those who've been given mandate by the people to execute that mandate and to wait for 5 years until they go back to the people. We need to get to a point where, as a country, when elections are over, they are over. Let us move on to the next election cycle. It cannot be a situation that, on the basis of one man's word, an entire electoral process is rubbished and disputed. And when that person asks, bring evidence which can sustain your allegations, he says, no, there's no evidence, but my word is gold.
Joseph Kioko is a Kenyan political analyst speaking with us from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with some cricket news. South Africa completed the highest successful chase in T20 cricket of 259 as they beat West Indies by 6 wickets in a record-breaking run fest at Centurion. Quinton de Kock smashed a 15-ball 50 and a 43-ball 100 as South Africa topped West Indies 258-5 with 7 balls to spare, making 259-4 in 18.5 overs. The match is the highest scoring in the history of T20 cricket, with 517 runs amassed across the course of a remarkable encounter at the SuperSport Park. Quinton de Kock was named the man of the match for his century, and here's what he had to say.
No, it's quite special. I think I've been searching for it for a while. Obviously, we don't play much T20 cricket internationally here at Centurion, and when we do, I seem to be giving off that game. So to come and do it here at the home ground was quite special. He was quite the silent assassin, just doing what Reza does. He helped me quite along, which was nice. And we said to him when he got out, I said, geez, we did something really special out there, and we're both proud of what you've done.
And now to athletics, where Kenyan Hilary Kipkoech won the Madrid Half Marathon on Sunday. Kipkoech crossed the finish line in a time of 59 minutes, 56 seconds in the World Athletics River Road Race Series. Ethiopia's Tekile Bikila finished second in 1 hour, 49 seconds, while Ashagri Tisema completed the podium with a personal best of 1 hour, 56 seconds. Zuiditu Andrea of Ethiopia took home the women's title with a time of 1 hour, 7 minutes, 38 seconds. Alimetu Tariku, also of Ethiopia, finished second with a personal best time of 1 hour, 7 minutes, 49 seconds. Ayinadis Shehome earned bronze with a time of 1 hour, 9 minutes, 02 seconds. In boxing news, Pearl Dlamini, the first African woman to serve on the board of the International Boxing Association, is advocating for the increase in prize money for female boxers. Dlamini, who has been president of the Swaziland Boxing Association for the last 9 years, says increase in prize money for women boxers will translate to huge benefits for the women and their families, especially in Africa.
If you look at the case of Elaine from Mozambique, whose story was shared to all of us today, she has been able to sort of like build her family from the funds that she gets from the prize money. So IPA somehow is improving lives and touching lives directly. Because some of these women boxers here, they are actually not benefiting alone, but their entire families are benefiting from the process of this prize money. So please, prize money everywhere, even in the local federation championship.
And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, March 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Butte in Washington, wishing you will have a great week.
For the past 17 years, the United States honors women of influence around the world who courageously advocates for rights of citizens, often in the face of government oppression or threat. This week on Our Voices, we'll look at this year's recipients of the International Women of Courage Award and explore how their bravery and commitment contributes to create a better society. Join the conversation Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on The Voice of America.